Hello and welcome to episode 2 of PieCast, the Pie Folk Podcast. Today we are making sausage and
collard green
with ponzu and what else did I put it?
Molasses.
Molasses and ponzu, sharp cheddar mini quiches. And I'm sitting here in my kitchen with Dale Cooper, who is an adult film star.
Hi, everybody.
He's waving. And Mr. Kevin Allison of the MTV's The State and the Risk podcast. Hello.
Hello. Kevin. Hello.
And we were talking about normalizing kink. And we were talking a little bit about what it's like to work in the adult film industry. And we're talking a little bit about comedy. So, let's see. I think the first thing I'd like to ask, I'd really like to ask Dale, how'd you get into doing porn?
Well, the very first time I did it, I was 18 or 19, and I was in college, and I had signed up for this big charity fundraiser bike ride thing, and I had a donor pull out the last minute of a substantial amount of money. So I had to then make up that money very quickly, and I actually answered an ad on Craigslist. And that was the first time I did it. And more recently, I got into it when I was laid off, and it was a recession, and I was a recent college grad, so things just... I had a friend in the industry sort of pointed my way towards it, so...
Okay.
Which was really nice.
So what's been your experience so far?
Oh, that's kind of a large question. To stay general, I suppose, I've really enjoyed the amount of free time and flexibility it gives me. I can work once a month and stay, if I live frugally, stay comfortable for that entire month. Just make sure all my major bills are out of the way and all that, which is really nice. I have a lot of time to devote to other projects, to my own personal development as opposed to just professional.
What kind of projects?
Most of what I do now is basically basic research and reading. I have my awesome fans sort of provide my reading material for me. I have a wish list, which is very common for porn performers, for fans to get them things. And I only have books on there, so it's like a big reading list of books I want, and fans buy them for me. So it keeps me very busy reading and writing notes from that. So that's what I do most of my spare time.
No, wait, where are these wish lists?
It's on Amazon. It's the most common place. I actually kind of feel bad because there's a really great, actually, in Baltimore where I'm from, there's a really great communist bookstore, if I may shout out to Red Emma's, which has a really awesome critical theory section, which I was hoping to get them to somehow be the purveyors of the books. So I hope a small business, local business, and all that at the same time. But you can't really argue with the convenience of Amazon. Like, people, it's a one-click thing. Like, send it as a gift, it's done.
Right.
There's something about the ability to purchase something for someone, particularly a porn performer, sort of anonymously, that people find really appealing.
If you get much bigger in porn, will you start putting, cars or,
I made a decision to just have it be books.
Yeah, but those things evolve as we change as artists, right?
Right. Well, surely.
Car.
Well, I could use a car if anyone out there has a couple of $1,000 laying around they don't need.
Now you're being a capitalist.
Yes, I know.
Wow. So, Kevin, you have been able to ask the universe for things and they've been bestowed upon you just through your podcast, right?
Yes, indeed. Okay. Yeah, I on my podcast, I started at Risk. The whole idea is that people come on and tell stories that they can't tell anywhere else, that you couldn't tell on NPR, or, you're not even supposed to share in mixed company. Mm-hmm. So some of the stories are really emotional, some of them are X-rated, and some of them are just ridiculous, but I've told a lot of stories about some of my recent explorations into kink, and so there was a episode several months back where I said, I think I'll just put this out there. I would really love a naked Asian house cleaning boy.
And you got one.
And I got one. Now, you have to understand, there's a context here. BDSM service kink is very popular. It's a whole, there are a lot of people who are into cleaning your house and getting a sexual charge out of it. The Asian part, that was just a part of my own personal, you know, I'm attracted to Asian guys.
Yeah, so you and I share an appreciation for Asian faces and bodies.
Well, I felt bad about the way it came out because it sounded like I was saying, I want an Asian to come clean my house. You know what I mean?
Did it?
I think that's kind of unavoidable.
Yeah.
If you were into gingers and said that, like, no one would blink, right?
Right.
No, what I meant was, you know, I would like, someone who is into this sort of thing to contact me. A kid from Malaysia did. 23 years old. He was going to be a student at Parsons. He's like, I'm moving to the States. I'm super into this. I saw you also on the BDSM sites. Let's start having Skype sessions and talk about how we can make this happen. Cool. And he did move in with me about a month later. Wow. And you know what? I was too damn nice.
Oh.
I was too, you know, once he moved in with me, I was like, here is a 23-year-old student who's new to the United States. Mm-hmm. And I just started encouraging him. I was like, you know what? I'm poly, so you should probably give dating guys your own age a shot. And I just kept, like, encouraging him to do nice things. And I think I was dropped out of his zone of, oh, you're not being mean and domineering and this, that,
so
and the
other. Right. Fulfilling his sexual needs of someone being like, you know, you're my Malaysian
slave
boy. He's like,
I didn't come all the way from Malaysia to get a mommy. Yeah. Well, now let's make with the butt smacks.
Exactly. Well, no, that's the thing. When it comes to kink, I am good at improvising. I'm good at going into the scene. So we were enjoying sex together, but otherwise I wasn't a 24/7 hard-ass asshole to him, and I think he grew bored with me.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
How clean was the apartment?
Oh, that it was. He was really good at... Now, that's another reason. It was also purely practical. Yes, I'm horrible at keeping the apartment clean.
And he was very good at it.
Yeah, and I figured, you know, I know a lot of pro-doms who are women who, like, they can... There are guys, straight guys, lining up out the door to clean their apartments who pay them, who pay the women for the honor of cleaning their apartment. So I'm like, why should I be paying a Latina woman down the street when I can find a dude who gets off on it?
Right. To qualify, you live in a Latina neighborhood.
Yes. Yes.
I wanted to qualify that Kevin does not think.
No, because I actually do have a Latina woman who does clean the apartment now.
Oh, cool.
And there's no sex involved.
Yet. Yet. You're no stranger to having sex with women, if it's the right context. So, let's see. So, I want to talk then maybe a little more about porn, in the sense that you said a couple of positive things about it. Is there anything negative? Do you feel judged by the community? Do you see yourself as a role model?
Well, I think it depends how you define community, first of all. There is the performer community, which, you know, sort of has these interactions and sort of, you know, like, I guess the usual thing, we get a bunch of gay guys together, it's gossipy, and people are, like, sort of chatting each other up and hitting one another up constantly. I don't actually indulge in that too much. And I think, actually, a big part of that is I don't have a smartphone, so I can't, like, you know, when people tweet at me, I can't be like, oh, hey, you know, smiley face, other emoticons.
Right.
You know, like, I'm in L.A. for 2 days, let's grab dinner. I don't have that sort of functionality.
Well, how do you do Grindr? I met you on Grindr.
That's true. I have a iPod Touch, which was given to me by a very good friend of mine. And it's really, it's perfect, particularly for when I travel, because I don't know my way around New York, for example, at all. So it'd be great if I can find Wi-Fi, I can route my way around. If I need to get fucked, I can jump on Grindr and find stuff, but I don't have that constant internet pressure of notification this and message that and text here and whatnot.
Yeah, it changes your life.
It does, and I've seen that. And I've and actually, going back to the porn question, I've been at a table full of performers and producers in, like, a public setting, and we'll be at a long table, there'll be 9 of us, and everyone is on their smartphone, and they're not texting each other, they're communicating with other people. I don't know if they're, like, you know, checking in at the location they're at?
I had to start doing that in my improv classes. I had to start saying, like, there's no iPhone use. Mm-hmm. Like, we can't iPhone, and I'll be like, I'll pick up my iPhone and check it. I'm not checking my messages. I'm checking to see what time it is so I know when we're going on break. Right. And I literally, I had to be very stern with a certain class that I'm teaching right now because there's a couple of ADD kids in it who are very talented. I like a lot, but like if I don't like, I literally, I have to be like an old school teacher with the, like I'm like, no grooming yourself. Stop combing your hair. Get off your phone. Don't talk when I'm talking. These are my notes.
Ruler smacked into some of that teacher student kink thing. Put on the dunce cap and sit in the corner.
Now clean the classroom. No one's blowing me.
I couldn't help but notice no one's blowing me.
If Armando Diaz is listening, I'm teaching your students, Armando.
It's actually gotten to the point where I'm not a big fan of jewelry or piercings or body adornment personally. I'd like to know other people, not on myself. But it's gotten to the point with smartphones where I actually feel like I want to get a watch just so I can check the time without giving the appearance that I'm on my phone looking at messages or whatever.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a silly thing to do because who gives a fuck, I guess. But I think, you know, we're all social creatures.
So yeah.
We all give a fuck in some level.
I suppose so. So let's get back to storytelling. You kind of self-actualized a couple years ago and you took yourself from a point of, I feel like you, the way that you spin the tale is that you were almost ready to give up comedy altogether.
I actually did. I did give up comedy. After the state broke up, I had always been the black sheep in the state. I had been like the middle child who's off in his own universe. You know, they say that Mel Brooks, when he was writing for Your Show of Shows with Woody Allen and Neil Simon and Sid Caesar, they would always laugh like hell at his sketches in the writer's room and say, all right, well, we can't use that.
Right.
I was that guy in the state. Everyone loved my stuff. We could never put it on TV.
Larry David had the same problem on SNL.
Oh, yeah. So when the group broke up, I was like, well, what do I do with myself now? Because I've always felt like I'm Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I've always felt like there's a part of me that's super, super polite and Midwestern and submissive and a Catholic boy from Ohio, and a part of me that's raunchy and kinky and a madman and likes experimenting with drugs and all that kind of stuff. So I just felt like audiences wouldn't know what to do with me, casting directors wouldn't know what to do with me.
Oh, tell me about it.
So finally, you know, after 12 years of starving, trying to do comedy, trying to be other characters, basically, on stage all the time, I did give up. I went into publishing for a while, and then I slowly realized, no, I've got to express myself somehow. Mm-hmm. But there was another thing. There's a part of me that needs to be able to express myself not solely in terms of comedy. There's a part of me that needs to be able to express myself under no restrictions. Like, oh, I don't have to be making people laugh every 8 seconds.
No.
So it was in 2008 when I first got up on stage and told a true story. Michael Black said, you've got to just drop the act and start speaking from the heart as yourself. I said, it's too risky. And he said, exactly.
Right.
Risk is where the good stuff comes from. So I tried a story on stage the next week. And it was all about how I tried to prostitute myself when I was like 20, and it didn't go very well. The story, the prostitution didn't go well, but the story went great. And from that point on, I said,
people just turned off to the prostitution element. But the story overall was good.
No. The prostitution, the story was about prostitution gone wrong.
Right.
But the story went over great.
Can I ask you a question? Were you afraid that you were like, oh, these are taboo subjects. These are taboo subjects. And then like people like, my Hollywood friends will disavow themselves of me. And, like, did you ever go through a sort of, like, what do they call that? The Valley of the Shadow of Death with Risk, where you felt like, uh-oh, like, this means all of my friends are not going to, like...
Oh, my God. They're, you know, with Risk, I was terribly, terribly paranoid during the first few months. And then when I started telling my first kinky stories, my first, like, really from the heart, stuff that didn't happen when I was a kid, where I'm like, ha, 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 isn't that ridiculous what I did when I was a kid?
Yeah.
But stuff that, like, I got my heart. But, like, the first time that I sat down with the microphone and told a story about something I was really wrecked about right then, right now, and I pressed send and put that story out there, I was terrified. I was like, what is the comedy community going to think of me? What might my parents eventually think of me?
Yep.
What might anyone in the entertainment industry think of me? And basically, my show is kind of a philosophical fuck you to that entire way of thinking.
Absolutely. I felt that way about Pie Folk in the sense that, like, I'd been doing comedy for 10 years. I was known as a comedian. East Village Boys contacted me and said, East Village Boys is like a blog. It's like a art, sexy, homoerotic art blog. Okay. And they were like, will you do apron-only photo shoot? And I thought, oh my God, all these straight male, white male comedian buddies of mine will never let me live it down. Mm-hmm. Also, my mom, like, she's gonna see it and then she's gonna go, well, I guess he's not really a comedy person. I guess he's just a porn star. Or I guess he's just like this or that. Exactly. Well, but overcoming that shame or overcoming the idea of what will people think, it's been a constant thing to remember. I always have to sort of brush up that little creeping voice inside me that no one will do your site. No one will take you seriously. No one will this and that. But then what I found is, well, first of all, prostitution, porn, all that stuff, that's in the Bible.
It's all so basic.
People have been born of that for thousands of years. Like, it's not that big of a deal or whatever.
I almost feel like, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I almost feel like, speaking of risk, that the title of your show, that's any internet exposure. It's like the people now with their Facebook profiles, with their Twitters, etc., you're in a constant state of managing risk. Like, what photos are allowed me to get out there? You have to constantly police your online identity because it has repercussions. You can try to pretend it's separate from your real self.
That's a great point. That's a great point. And I feel like we're on the avant-garde, the people who are saying, we have to be a lot more conscious about what we're putting out there in the world. And you know what? We're consciously choosing to put it all out there.
Not all of it, but
like,
I never show penis or nutsack on my site because I always want my grandmother, I know my grandmother has seen the site, and I know that my mom and dad regularly read my site, and I don't want them to see my nutsack.
they've seen it before.
It's been like 30 some odd years since they have seen it,
right.
And they don't want to see it again.
Right.
That's
understandable.
But I feel like, or I had to stop myself from tweeting. I pooped yesterday, and it what happened was it was like one log of poop, right? And then there was like a little follow up, just like a tiny dollop. That wound up landing on the log, and it looked like either a shark or a submarine, and I photographed it, and I was like, I'm going to tweet this. And then I was like, wait a minute, I'll lose followers if I tweet this. Not everyone thinks that poop is funny like I do.
You manage yourself. You're like PR firm.
So I sent it to my friend Gretchen Poole, who talks about poop with me all the time, and I know that she'll like it, and I have not heard back from her.
She has blocked you.
I am even... like, it literally was just one text, and like, she literally was like, too much, Michael, too much.
could I wind back the conversation a little bit? Because you use a term that I'm honestly, despite your really great story, I'm still not sure what it means.
What?
You
poop tweet?
By self-actualize, actually.
Oh!
And I was going to ask you, because you brought up your stories with kink and whatnot, and how you felt like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Does your kink play in terms of being dom or sub, come into play in your everyday life where you feel like you have to, particularly as a performer, where you're constantly putting on roles? Does doing kink make you feel more true to yourself, or is it also just a play acting thing?
I have not been in enough scenes with super, super serious kinksters where the role playing was taken seriously enough to feel like I went into subspace, or to feel like I went into a part of my psychology that I was on. It happened basically once. I had a kink experience once that was like an out-of-body sort of experience where I all of a sudden found myself being submissive in a way I had never thought I would enjoy, and feeling toward another man a way that I I was basically bowing at someone's feet and like worshiping him like an emperor, and doing things like smelling his shoes and getting whipped and all that sort of thing, and going into this kind of like out of body, almost drug like experience of being like, wow, I feel like I'm in touch with a part of my psychology that I just didn't even know was there. And so that for me became, that was very early on in my getting into kink, and I shared it immediately on the podcast. Yeah. So that's a little bit of
a touching story, though. The way that you tell it now is sort of matter of fact, but when I listened to that, I was running in McCarran Park, and I literally had to stop and cry.
Yeah. It took me back to being a little boy, basically.
Yeah.
And it was very emotional. And so I think that ever since I had that experience, I've been super, super curious. When can I meet a kinkster who takes things seriously enough and is into the psychological aspects of things enough that I can go back into that mysterious realm? But it's difficult to say. You can't really force that kind of thing. You never know. It is kind of an adventure. You meet people.
Uh-huh.
Everyone has totally different levels of kink play that they're into, or extents to which they'll even call themselves kinky.
I was asking about that before when we were making the pies. I was like, well, am I kinky? Because like sometimes me and my boyfriend, I'll be like, oh yeah, little brother, you're doing great. You're doing great, little bro. Big bro's happy. Or whatever, when we're having sex or something. And some of it is just to see what I can get away with. But some of it is also because I know that it will make him excited, and like if it makes him excited, then that makes me happy. Or and then it's like that's like the smallest level of kink, right? It like is role play.
Oh yeah, I think that there's that's really charged. Yeah. Trying stuff out like that, where you're like I think they call it sapiosexuality.
What's
aspect,
that?
The kink play that's mostly about the mind, about the brain,
so
and psychology. That stuff like really intrigues me because you never know, especially if you're just randomly hooking up with someone. You really don't know where that might.
Yeah,
but it can be really fascinating if you're doing it with someone that you do know and that you do care about.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
What I found is that it doesn't make us feel limited. It makes us feel more expansive. Like, oh, wow, so we can have sex and I'm your older brother. And then next time I'm your dad. And then next time I'm your camp counselor. Next time you're my camp counselor.
That I particularly like. I particularly like the turning of the tables.
Well, it's funny. My boyfriend and I have been saying this phrase to each other like once or twice, like recently, like which is that there's no such thing as an Asian bottom. Because were we talking about this on the podcast? Or earlier we were talking about, you had brought up, Dale, that you were like, what do you think about the myth of the Asian bottom? Or like the myth of the submissive Asian? And I was like, well, it's something that we talked about a lot. Which is that like, oh, any Asian that I've ever dated has topped me a lot. And so like I don't know that like I like that's just one of those categoric things where I'll be like, there's no such thing as an Asian bottom, not at least not until Asians stop getting categorized as bottoms, then maybe there could be an Asian bottom.
I think a lot of gay men are way too locked into the idea of top and bottom in terms of anal penetration with a cock. Like there are so many other ways to play with an ass than putting a dick in it.
Right.
Or just play with a body, just in general. All sex is intercourse.
I'm just always turned off by people who are too locked into one particular label and thinking of sex one-dimensionally.
Well, then this sort of goes back to what we were talking about earlier pre-podcast about what counts as a fetish nowadays, what counts as kinky sex in a way. Because I think we were talking about, like, for example, when you're looking for your Malaysian houseboy, that was just something that sort of fell out, which you guys both mentioned.
To be fair, it could have been Japanese.
It could have been. India
is in Asia. We'll accept that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? If it was Jeopardy question, we would have to accept the answer.
Right, absolutely. I have to admit, I've always, you know, I wouldn't say if it's necessarily a fetish, but I've always had a love for South Asian and Middle Eastern men.
Like, hello.
It's, you know, I think it's really hot. I want to find, like, a really hot South Asian man who can cook me amazing, you know, like, South Indian food. but, you know, but regardless, I feel like it's kind of one of the interesting things, particularly with the, like, internet age we were talking about earlier, how people have started to sort of request certain things. Like, I'm looking for a partner who is X, Y, and Z, which I think is sort of the opposite of the play you guys are talking about, where, like, you're just you, but right now you're you and you're a camp counselor, and I'm the, and, you know, and I'm me, but I'm me who's, like, a bad, you know, camper who ran off.
Yeah.
You know, wasn't supposed to.
I've done kinky stuff before, but I don't seek it out. What happens is, when I'm physical with somebody, I go, what are they asking for? Or I go, what can I get away with?
Right.
Depending on my mood that day. And I think it's led me to kinky places. I mean, I've, like, you know, sorry, Mom. But, Mom, stop listening to the podcast if you listen to the podcast. I had a boyfriend for a second where, like, he was obsessed with the idea that I would pee up his butt. And we were, like, monogamous at the time, and so we were having bareback sex. And one Christmas Eve, again, sorry, Mom, we did it on Jesus's day. But I drank a lot of wine, and then we went to the shower, and I peed, and I got a boner, and I stuck it in, and, like, I took a lot of concentration.
Yeah, quite
a bit of concentration, but I peed up his butt. And then he was like, now fuck me. And I was like, what? And then I had to do that, and when he came, this is way too much information, Mom. By this point, you should have shut off the podcast, Mom. When he came, a lot of urine gushed down on my thighs, which you would think would be gross, but it was literally like love trickling down my legs.
That's amazing.
It's like butt cum.
Audience, Kevin is beside himself. Kevin is literally hopping from one foot to another doing... No, he's not. But, like, I just imagine him doing, like, some sort of football end zone victory dance.
Yeah, well, that's... I mean, you know, I think I make the mistake too often of being too... Like...
Too specific?
Not too specific for what I'm looking for, but too specific about who I am. I feel it's very necessary to get out of the closet as soon as possible on whatever, Grindr or Manhunt or FetLife or whatever, that I tend to be kinky, and that I would prefer to have open kinds of relationships. In other words, I'm kind of a poly sort of guy.
Polyamory is what you're talking about, right?
Yeah.
Well, I was actually going to ask you this along those lines, is I feel like particularly on websites like, or applications like, like Grindr, where you're just interacting, there's this sort of desire to just look for something very specific, like you would say, oh, people under 30, please, or not my age, or like, no one over 170 pounds, like this, there can be this incredible degree of specificity.
No Muslims.
And I'm just curious in
no the, green eyes.
In the sort of kink world, which is not something I admittedly have much experience with, is there that same level of specificity, or do people get together and talk about what scenario they find hot? And, you know, like, if you're attracted to the person, obviously that's important, but you'd be like, this is a situation or thing that I like happening, and the person doing it matters, of course, but not as much of the physical vision of a person. You know, like, Grindr is all about that square of that image of that person.
Yeah. The time that I did it that we were referring to before, when I was with the Chinese 25-year-old, there was so much texting and phone calls before we ever saw each other. We're in role-playing. He would ask me what my fantasies were. He would present fantasies to me, like, I'll bet you'd love this. Like, at one point, I remember him painting this whole thing with, I used to... go to this all-boys school in Hong Kong, I'll bet you would have loved to have been the principal and to have lined us all up and made us take our pants off. And I was like,
yes. Yeah, where is this Hong Kong, you say? I'm looking at a ticket right now.
So that, I feel, really was a, like, as good as it gets. Like, two people feeling each other out. On FetLife, which is like Facebook for kinksters, everyone has a gigantic list of thousands of fetishes that you can check off. So everyone can compare, oh, I see you like this, I like that too, that sort of. I mean, there are guys, there are kinksters that I get together with solely for rimming. Like, it's like...
Rimming is a very...
is that a fetish? Rimming?
Yeah, isn't
well, aggressive rimming is,
that was
right?
Kind of
one of the
about.
Biggest...
I'm an aggressive rimmer.
One of the things that I've discussed a lot with straight people is what you guys call fetishes and kink. That's like the first date.
Yeah. Audience, that's Adam Gardner, who is our resident photographer, chiming in.
Rimming isn't...
It's so funny.
It's you know, that's like... That's the first date.
You know, I...
Kind of. I mean...
Because I knew...
If the date goes well. If the date's going well, a rim job will be administered.
Oh, beautiful.
I just took the pies out of the oven. They look great. We have to let them cool, and then we'll eat, but we'll keep talking.
You know, I knew I was gay when I was still in diapers, and so I was way into boys' butts when I was a kid. So rimming became like even when I was a kid, like this obsession of mine, but I was convinced it was the raunchiest, the most nasty, the most unnatural thing a person could possibly do. So I remember I had a Jungian therapist when I turned 30.
Oh, that's funny.
And I would go into her and I would be like, I really like rimming. And she'd be like, uh-huh.
Oh, like, you got fucked up in the anal stage. I was like, I'm sorry.
No, she would just say, uh-huh. And then I'd come back the next week and be like, no, you don't understand. I like rimming. And she finally had to say to me, you know, that doesn't make you special. You are not shocking me.
But the first time that I know I experienced it, it felt like, this is
right.
New
like,
level.
This is the biggest time
the
ever
first time
happened.
You got rimmed or did
the
rim
first time? No, the first time I got rimmed, I was like, it was a brand new level of sexuality, and
yeah,
I was like, you can do that.
Yeah,
like,
oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, and it feels like some sort of magical fairy dance is happening on my butthole, and I want it to happen forever. That's when I was like 18 or something, right? Now all of the nerve endings are shot, and so if you rim me, you probably should do it with like a heated up fire tong or something. Like then I'd feel it.
Right.
But, like, ultimately, I don't feel it anymore, but doing it is amazing.
Yes.
Well,
yeah,
I feel
like
that's so funny because particularly as young kids, we're all trained. You know, like your butthole is the most private of all your private parts.
Right.
You don't tell anyone about it. Like you don't talk to me about your poops unless you have diarrhea and you're sick, and that's when mom.
Yeah,
needs to know
if
right?
you must.
It
yeah.
is right. It is the most private thing about your body. Like even now,
humiliation too. You could really humiliate somebody. In that
right. Absolutely.
Dare
I feel
you
like...
digest food? Yeah. How dare you?
Right. It's so weird. I feel like even now, where like we become more lax with, particularly with the like male body, what can be shown in like movies or art or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like penis is A-okay. You do not show someone's asshole.
No.
That's like, no, the final frontier. Like, spread brown eye shots. Thank you.
Even in porn, because I remember
even
coming
porn,
to NYU in 88 and I was like, I watched it gradually become more and more okay to
uh-huh.
show butthole in gay porn.
Right.
And I was like, I am very happy with this.
Right. Before it was just like, there's this idea, like you see someone fucking and you know what they're fucking. Exactly, but you don't necessarily see it. You just know that the act of fucking is happening.
Yeah.
Well, you brought up something that I did want to touch on. I wanted to touch on the subject.
My anus.
Yes, I do want to touch your anus, and if that's an invitation, we can speak about that later or right now. Anytime you want to speak about me touching your anus, I'll yes.
We can press pause.
Well, Adam does have his camera at the ready.
Yeah, no. I don't like it.
Oh, fair enough.
Not always.
No free sex.
That's actually not true, so I should take back. Anyway, continue, please.
I wanted to know about shame. I want to know what you guys feel like the use of, in the human psyche, what, when is shame appropriate and when is shame not appropriate? Because I feel like the gay community is basically sick with the disease of shame. And it makes me sad. It makes me sad when a person is ashamed to admit that they're a bottom. It makes me sad when a person is ashamed to admit that they're gay to their family. It makes me sad when I see a person who is super gay at a gay bar trying to pretend like they're straight at work. Mm. All levels of shame. And I wanted to open up the floor for either... Because here we have a man who runs a podcast which is about... not feeling shame. Mm-hmm. But I know that you came from a Catholic background. Yeah. I know that a lot of your stories are about exploring and overcoming shame. Mm-hmm. And here we have another man who participates in a profession that requires you to be somewhat shameless. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder how we evolve into people that don't use shame against ourselves.
You know, one day at a time, I would say. I would say that my worst enemy has always been myself. You know, I at a certain point, I realized that risk, at a certain point early on in Risk's inception, I was like, oh, this is ultimately kind of a fuck you to my mother. Because my mother was the one who mostly poured shame over me. We weren't allowed to say the word sex in the house. Come Sexual on. Healing by Marvin Gaye had to be turned off when the radio came on.
Oh, no.
So, but it was more than that. It was, don't run up the stairs like that. You look like a girl. Don't gesture so flamboyantly. Don't, you know, let your face use such big expressions. So... a lot of self-loathing around, oh my God, what will the neighbors think? And knowing that that was the highest priority to a lot of folks back there at home. And I think that what happens now is that I carry a lot of that in my head. I mean, you know, I still feel like I come out of the closet with something and then feel like, holy fuck, did I say too much? Should I be ashamed? You know what I mean? And then I have to remind myself philosophically, no, you stand. You are, you know, you're standing up against that.
Right.
Day by day.
Well, I mean, anytime that, like, we start, anytime that when I'm with my mom and dad and the conversation veers toward what I'm doing online and the agenda that I'm pushing online, I immediately go, well, luckily, because... I worry that they worry about what my website will do for me, and what will what the negative side of that will be too. And I just immediately go, well, luckily I have parents that raised me to never be ashamed of myself, and so if I'm doing this, it's because I'm proud of myself, and I know that you're proud of me. And then they just sort of circle up and go, that's right, that's right, that's the way to think.
You remind them almost of your own upbringing.
I'm a victim of their shame too. I mean, they told me that they were disgusted by my sexuality. They told me that my mom told me she wished that she'd had an abortion. But at the same time, they have come to love me and love the fact that I'm gay because we have always had an open dialogue. I've always been, and I've had an ally in my older brother who was like just sort of a confirmed atheist from the age of like 14. I remember being like in high school and him like giving me things like Camus the Stranger and be like, read this. or like Thus Spoke Zarathustra, I read when I was in high school. Because my older brother was like, all this religious stuff is crazy.
Read in high school.
He sort of was like, yes, mom and dad think super this, but you could think this. and so I had an ally in the family, and I think that we've done a lot of removing the homophobia from our family, a lot of removing the racism from our family, a lot of removing, like, any of the things that, like, misogyny, even. I mean, it's hard for my mom. It's a house full of boys. Mm. It's three boys and my dad, and so, like, there's a lot of misogynist elements going on, too.
Right.
So I just to, like, keep the dialogue open, I think, is helpful for me. What about you? Like, did you ever, like, think, oh, gosh, this is going to affect the rest of my life, or...
Well, of course. I mean, I think you have to come to terms with that before you ever choose. I mean, to do anything that's out in the open, you have to be aware that the publicity of that, you know, can very much come back and bite you in the butt if you're not willing to accept those consequences. But I was more interested in doing this more along, like, the sort of relationship that gay men have to the term shameless. I feel like the term shameless is almost a substitute for like the flamboyant gay man. And in a way, I'm a little torn in that because I think that, you know, particularly with all the talk of gay pride and being out and proud and loud and all of that, we've really, and particularly with the kind of 21st century environment that we live in now, humility, like, as something that we used to think of as a virtue, and no longer is really held up in any circles. But I sort of feel like part of the growing pains of the homosexual, we can call it the gay lit movement, or just equal rights in America, was fighting against this sort of classic Midwestern American ideal of being humble, right? Of being contained in and of yourself. And that if you're out and proud, particularly in a gay way, that's completely antithetical to that, right? Like, you're broadcasting a very private thing, your sexuality. You're taking it out there and you're telling all your neighbors, and there's this idea that this is, you know, that's, you should not do that, and that's bad, and that's, you know, we'd be spanked by some father figure up there or whatever.
See? We can get to it through shame. Right. Well, daddy's going to spank me? Well, then I'm very ashamed.
Right. But I also feel like in some way, like, I feel like as a community, like, I think we should be reminded that humility is also a really great thing too, you know, like being humble and being reserved can also in and of itself be very sexy. That's a big turn on for me. It's a very, for example, a very sexy man who is aware of his sexuality but does not flaunt it.
I mean, for me, I think that that's sexy from my point of view. I don't know that there is such a thing as a comedian who is good.
That's very true.
Who is
very
humble.
That's very true.
Except only to be humble about the process of comedy. Almost every good comedian is humble about the process. But when you get on stage, there's a certain part of like, my shit doesn't stink, and here's why.
Right.
I'm thinking of Chris Rock. I'm thinking of, who else has a lot of swagger? Zach Galifianakis, or like Monique, or like anybody in the community that's like, well, or like Lisa Lampanelli. Like, how do you get away with that without that sort of mega swagger?
You know, it's interesting that you bring up Lisa, because I know her and she's done Risk. She gets up on stage and she insults the hell out of everybody. You know, attacks.
Yeah, talks about big black dick and how she loves black dick, but the only problem with dating black men is that you can't get a mortgage because of their credit.
And then when the lights go down and you speak to Lisa, she is the sweetest, most down-to-earth, most humble-seeming person. She is a regular Joe, and you're just so touched that, oh my gosh, you don't have any of that diva-esque attitude that we associate with famous people.
Right.
And so yeah, I think that I appreciate what you're saying. It's a nuanced thing. There are ways to be humble without being shameful.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, humility and shame are not the same thing, right?
No, absolutely. And also, we have a very, there's a very different sort of focus in our professions. You know, you guys are comedians, and it's sort of about being raw. Whereas what I do, yeah, we're like, you know, we're naked. We're not necessarily nude, I would say.
Yeah,
but there's so much post-production and editing and photoshopping.
Yes.
So it's all about this image, which is often, you know, more than not highly doctored. The romance you see on screen is highly doctored. Sorry, I know everyone knows this is true, but...
Yeah,
but
when you're doing your job right, and when you hit upon a scene that gets a lot of likes or a lot of, like,
correct,
fans,
right,
it's because you're raw.
Exactly.
And I don't mean not using condoms, although that does help too.
That's a whole different topic, honey.
I know you're not a condom boy, and I am currently not a condom boy because I'm having sex with the same person over and over again. I'm being monogamous right now. I'm in a period of monogamy, which is not it wasn't negotiated. We just sort of fell into it, and so I'm not using condoms right now. We both got an AIDS test, you know,
This is delicious, by the way.
But I meant raw in the sense that it's like, there's a real chemistry there. You're not worried about the camera, only to just check in and make sure that you're turning out toward it. But, like, ultimately it is about the chemistry between you and the other person, right?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I think with any acting, that's what you're hoping to capture or hoping to sort of bring out. But, you know, that's a process. Some days are better than others. You never know.
Adam, will you speak about shame?
In what regard?
I don't know.
Just it's such an expensive thing.
It is a really expensive topic.
Yeah, well...
I just came back from the Midwest, so I could go on for an hour.
Were you raised there?
I was, yeah.
Where?
In South Dakota.
Mm. Oh, wow.
Missouri, Cincinnati, South Dakota.
Texas.
Oh. And I was born into originally a Mormon family, at which point we left the Mormon church and then Utah in order to escape from...
Was it LDS?
What I would call persecute, yeah. Of like mild persecution sort of thing, but... So there's plenty of dialogue about shame in my family and in the context of my upbringing. And one of the things that you guys hit on that I think really hit me, or that was very familiar, was this idea of being a dignified person, because I feel like when my parents saw me as being a person with dignity, then it was easier for them to be like, oh, well, he's gay. Because they had some, you know, and that's okay. Like, it's all right that he's gay because he's dignified. And I felt the same
he's
thing.
He's one of the good ones.
I
that's
was
great.
Accepted by my grandfather because... Okay, he's gay, but he's dignified, and that makes it all right. If he was flamboyant, then I'm not really sure how my parents would have reacted, or
oh,
would have, you know what I mean? If,
yeah, levels of gayness
and
covering.
I'm a quiet kind of guy. I prefer to do things without making a lot of noise about it, and that's not what they assume to be a gay person's personality.
Does that ever invoke? Do you ever find yourself like getting angry to be like, well, you love me because I'm one of the good gays or one of the normal gays?
No, but I think
I'm making air quotes when I say normal.
It has to be. I'm sure it's a factor, but I don't.
Air quote alert.
I don't believe that. I think my parents were very fundamentally involved with religion enough that no matter how I acted or behaved or whatever, that they would have. They had to make a decision about whether or not to choose their religion or me, and it was that powerful that. No matter who I was or what I was like, that would actually be the thing that got in the way or that had to be overcome. Or,
right.
So I think it was just more comfortable for them to be like, but he's not really flamboyant. Okay.
Well,
and there was the issue of safety. Is he going to get his ass kicked when he goes to school? Because the quieter and more subdued you are, the more, you know. If I'm drawing attention to myself, I'm going
to
get my
well,
ass
Kevin
kicked.
And I just did it this way. We had to be the most popular people in high school. And then we could be as gay as we wanted to. I was class president. You were also class president?
I was big in the musical theater in my
me too.
High school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I could be openly gay as long as everyone liked me and the football players would beat up anybody that didn't.
I was the exact opposite. I was the kid in the back of the bus reading like J.R.R. Tolkien books, you know? Like,
oh, I also read those.
I was very quiet. I was very long. Oh, yeah. I think a lot of gays did. There's an interesting connection between fantasy and sci-fi.
Sam and Frodo are fucking each other, right?
Absolutely.
On the way to Mordor.
But I was actually going to ask to your point, Adam. I think it's kind of curious now that, particularly in terms of dignity, has come to mean normalcy in terms of like a normal family structure, right? So now that gay men and their allies and lesbians and, you know, all their advocates and whatnot are starting to really get some positive reactions for the battles for like marriage rights, you know, like there's this move towards this sort of normal family structure that people can understand, like, oh, we don't get your sexuality per se, but when you start organizing it in the like usual family structure, except it's just two men instead of a man and a woman, that becomes something I can understand kind of.
Yeah,
thing. Do you
well,
feel
I,
that kind of pressure
I,
from your family? Does that make sense?
Yeah,
you know,
I mean, my father is like the proverbial Jewish mother. Whenever I call, he's like, when are you going to get a husband? It's legal in New York, Adam. I'm like, when are you going to get a husband? I'm like...
He wants grandkids.
No, he has grandkids.
He wants more. Okay. That's the only thing people over the age of 55 that have children care about is grandkids. I swear to God, when I say God, I mean, you know.
Well, more than that, I think he's been more like your brothers or partner. They have their companions for their lives. They're,
right.
You know, they have their wives and...
Right.
You know, we want you to have that companion in your life, too.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, if anything, it's really a very, very... I have a very supportive family, and I've been enormously lucky in the kind of people
that
I was raised by. And what they were willing to do in order to accept me as their son and as their gay son.
Me too.
Which I admire about them. I really think that they're... I think that I was more than anything very, very lucky. But that doesn't mean that, you know, we didn't have things to get over, but...
Yeah. Well, I think that brings up an interesting place where I think you and I concur with each other, Michael, in that there's a, like, in my podcast, I will talk about doing freaky shit, you know what I mean?
Right.
But I will talk about it in a way that is dignified. I'll talk about it in a way where I'm clearly an intelligent person who's looking through his emotions, who is compassionate and kind toward other people.
Right.
So I'm really trying to get you to see, you know what? Your idea is that I'm okay as long as I'm monogamous? No. Fuck that. I'll tell you how I feel about things, and if I can speak about it intelligently enough and authentically enough, you'll see that I too have dignity.
Right.
You know? And I think that the marriage thing is has skewed us a little bit at this the gay community at this point in our history. Polyamory is something that we actually were kind of on the forefront of, like, embracing and, like, finding our way through and, like, finding a way to be dignified about doing it or messing it up throughout, say, the 70s and all the earlier decades. And now I feel like I talk to guys in their 20s and they'll say, I'm 26, I haven't met the man I'm supposed to be with for the next 70 years. I'm a failure. I want to kill myself. And I'm like, darling, you are like fucked up by a skewed way of thinking that the rest of society says is A-okay.
However, in the defense, my grandparents were together for 68 years and it was a very joyous it's not that, and being a huge advocate for polyamory and not ever willing to say, like, I have to be monogamous only, I can only ever be this way. I'm not willing to say that because I don't want to close myself off to possibilities.
Right, there's an extreme.
But I have to say, I do also feel like the stability of the relationships that my grandparents and my parents had was a positive thing.
No, my parents are getting close to 55 years together. And I love them and they love each other. And you know what? I would be stunned if I ever found out that either of them had ever had sex with someone else.
Oh, I wouldn't be. I'm sure that, well, Mom, why are you still listening? I told you not to listen at least 20 minutes ago. My parents have been married to each other 3 times, divorced twice. They've had relationships with other people. And so I feel like when I say that I'm a polyamorous, I come from a proud tradition of it. they're together now, they're happy now, and that's what life is about. Life is about now.
Right.
And then when it wasn't working, they weren't together. And when it was working, they were together. And I think that it's a beautiful story. I think it's just as beautiful of a story to say, oh, they met in high school and they were together for 60 years. Well, my mom and dad have the same story. And they were on and off for 40 years. And that's beautiful. And if they break up again, I will still support them both.
Yeah.
Because every time I break up, they support me.
Yeah.
Well, and that's what unconditional love is.
Yeah.
And that's what I meant, I think, by, like, overcoming the shame of anything.
Yeah.
Like, where it's like, we don't point fingers in my family. We just go, oh, okay, the situation has changed. You were with that man for 8 years. Now you're not.
Well, talking about relationships and shame, I was with my husband, now ex-husband, for 9 years.
Yeah.
And the first thing you have to deal with when you're getting a divorce is, oh my God, I'm a failure. Society sees me as a failure. My relationship itself was botched.
Right.
But I've never felt that way. I've always felt like, you know what? Those were nine. I mean, obviously, there was a lot of ups and downs, but I do not regret the fact that we no longer have a relationship of that kind, and I don't regret the time we were together.
I would never do that. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry to interrupt. I was just going to say, I think it's kind of what you were discussing earlier. I think it's the sort of larger moral arc of homosexuality is that, particularly now where, like, the Defense of Marriage Act is being brought up to the Supreme Court, I think there's this really interesting moment where we still have people on the far right saying, well, this is a slippery slope. Like, homosexuality is still everything that isn't monogamous, heterosexual relationships. So it's going to be like a man fucking a donkey and marrying the donkey.
That donkey?
It's a gorgeous donkey. But
well, then.
What I think is the current imperative and where I find inspiration in contemporary queer politics is that we're currently being like, you know, we can marry, and this aspect of sexuality is distinct. And I think when we start to do that, and we do show that, you know, gay men and gay women can be in these loving couples together that are long-term, whether they're monogamous or not, you know, that's their own business. But I think when we start to do that, we can start being like, you know what, you guys have been thinking for decades that homosexuality is everything, but actually there's a big spectrum of
Within
heterosexuality, within homosexuality.
That's part of what I'm trying to do with Pyfolk is like, it's being like, whoa, those fags next door really are fucking all the time. They're naked, even when they're cooking food, they're naked and they're about to have sex.
Everyone can do that.
But it's like, well, so is the married heterosexual Italian couple next door. They're boning all, when they're not arguing, they are boning. Mamma Mia, are they boning. And I think that, like, that's so, like, normalizing us is a very important step. Buttoned up side of us that wants to be in a marriage, and also the kinky side of us that wants to open somebody's butthole with some forceps, or drip some candle wax on some nutsacks, or anything that you might, or just
talking about someone's
big brother.
Last weekend. No.
But, I think that was part of it, was, like, showing it that it's like, oh, does this freak you out? The fact that it's, like, homoerotic, but there's, like, a domestic element going on? Why would it? Right. Like, because you want homosexuals not to be domestic, because you're heterosexual, and you're heteronormative, and you think we don't deserve it. Well, we do.
Right.
And the time will come where it won't be an issue, but right now it is, and we have to, I guess, just gently remind people that we are not any stranger than any heterosexual couple, right?
And I have to say that when people make that argument of, like, what about marriage to animals? Mm-hmm. That worked 20 years ago. And people would be like, you're
still
right.
Saying
oh,
it
like,
on the house
they're saying
floor.
It,
I've seen some pretty cute mailboxes that I'd like to fuck.
I don't think it's landing. I really think that most people are like, I know the difference between homosexuality and bestiality.
Yeah.
Right.
I think it's an argument for the lowest common denominator, and I don't
and
think it's holding
it's
up
it's
anymore.
An older generation
blanket
statement about, you know, there are a lot of very progressive.
Well, slippery slope is never, anybody who says slippery slope, it basically means I know the opposite side is right. And this is
totally into
a gay water park. Because if it's a gay water park, I'll go to Slippery Slope.
Well, you know what I think is actually really good about this is that people will stop being like the only way you can divide sexualities between homo and hetero. People will start to be like numbers of partners, times of day, certain activities, certain fabrics, certain objects up my orifices, etc., etc. There will be other ways we can start to talk about sexuality once homosexuality becomes more or less mainstream and we allow anyone to get married and so on and adopt and get benefits.
And also, I think one of the things...
in the right direction.
Yeah.
I hope that straight people who identify as straight can now ride off of what is happening for gays that they can finally be like, a blowjob isn't part of fetish. Like, that they can start asking for things that they want and identifying a little bit more as queer themselves to get the things that they want. Because, I mean, really, that's a luxury that we get in exchange for being gay and seeing ourselves as outsiders, or assuming that people see us that way, is that we get to have these fetishes in there. It's not weird that we have them.
Right.
But Kevin knows straight guys that like to get fisted, right?
Well, I was trying.
But imagine what it takes if you're a married straight man to ask your wife to give you a rim job. That's
right.
Like,
marriages
you have to be
that,
together for a minute before you can
and you probably have to, like, navigate the politics of that for 6 months to be like, I'm hinting, I'm showing porn where they're doing it, now I'm doing this thing.
Guys
talk
about their annual blowjob. Like, I hope that gay people in, you know, making, in normalizing some things, disarming some things, can actually bring about, because I think straight people, or everybody really, could do with some more sexual adventure, really.
Well,
and I hope straight people can see that, like, okay, it's not fucked up that I am asking for this, because that's what people get to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's what we were talking about, how I went to that kink camp that was mostly not gay men. It was everyone else. And I was talking to Lee Harrington there, who is a, he was born as a woman, now a man. And he was saying, yeah, you know what? I come to this camp every year. And every year, because there's a philosophy of anything goes within this campground, more and more men are playing with each other. When you put forth a philosophy of it's okay to cross boundaries and try things, it just starts happening. So I think that's, you know, that's part of our job at this point in the evolution of gay history is to say, yeah, it's okay to be totally monogamous and married for 70 years, and it's okay to try different things as well.
Yeah.
Like rim jobs.
Yeah.
Or rim jobs while married for 70 years.
Yeah, absolutely. Just make sure it's clean first, guys. Just take a shower.
Right.
Unless you're
unless
into
you're
that
into
sort of
that.
Thing.
I was gonna say.
That's right.
Anybody have anything that they'd like to promote coming up? Adam? Anything? Any, like, exhibitions or... No?
I'm just doing the editorial work, so... my work is always in magazines.
All right, look for Adam on the pages of magazines.
Yeah.
Dale?
There are some things that I'm not at liberty to discuss yet, but I will say currently a collaborative project with a very good friend of mine, Victor Jeffries, who lives in Brooklyn, is coming up. Some people may know him from XU as This Is My Fake Name. We're now launching a site, This Is My Fake Site. We'll be putting our collaborative pornographic projects together on there as well. So be sure
cool.
to check that out.
Is it art
It'll
porn?
Be Googleable soon. You can call it whatever you want.
You call it porn.
I call them videos with erotic content. How about that?
Okay. I don't know. I prefer to call it porno because it makes me sound like I'm from the 70s. I still watch a porno. All right, Kevin, what you got coming up?
Well, Risk is always free on iTunes if you look for it under podcast, or you can find us at risk-show.com. There are stories that'll make you laugh and cry and everything in between.
Cool. All right. Well, thanks a lot for participating, and I'm gonna say let's dig into these pies. We already did. We already did.
Already had to.